God of all creation, we ask that you guide us in all of your ways, that you help us to be attentive to your life-sustaining presence. Amen. I'm spiritual but not religious, is a phrase I often hear in my chaplaincy work. People are hedging their bets, not wanting to associate with organised religion because, let's face it, so much harm has been caused by various groups in the name of God. I can understand it. But perhaps it's also saying that I acknowledge that there's more to me than my bones and my flesh. I'm not a robot. I have a soul, a spirit. We heard from Paul today in his speech recorded in Acts that we are definitely more than bodies. We are a created people, created to live and move and be in God, called to be present to the presence of God. In today's account in Acts, the Apostle Paul encounters some folks hedging their bets in Greece. He has travelled quite a bit in the stories that precede ours today. Ever the evangelist, he has been teaching and preaching in synagogues and has been run out of a few, including Thessalonica and Berea. I wonder if previously Paul came across as arrogant in his teaching or overbearing. In my family, my kids will refuse to listen to me if I'm not careful with my tone, no matter what I say. If I make my tone less confrontational and more invitational and curious and loving, I have great success, especially when they're involved with solving the dilemma or the problem at hand. In any case, Paul has travelled now to Greece, specifically Athens, and he's there waiting for his companions to arrive. Athens is no longer the centre of power in the Mediterranean world. That title belongs to Rome. Athens is a city known for its culture, a city of sun-washed beauty, wide streets, white marble columns and red tile roofs, a city of schools and theatres and forums of learning where arts and ideas flourish. While Paul waits, he decides to look around their marketplace, their synagogues and landmarks, and engage with some philosophers there. He must have talked quite a bit and annoyed some folks, because the Bible said that he got the reputation for being quite the talker, some apparently asking, what is this chatterbox trying to say? But here, where all good things under the sun are available for the asking, Paul discovers something is missing. Maybe it's not enough, say the people of Athens, that we worship the sun over our heads and the ground beneath our feet. Maybe it's not enough that we have an altar to the god of the harvest and the goddess of the hunt and the god of the sea. Maybe it's not enough that we can quote Epicurus and Plato. Maybe we need something else, just to make sure. We want to hedge our bets, say the people of Athens. So let's build an altar to an unknown god. Paul discovers this altar. We know this altar to an unknown god. In our day, we have managed to name and explain everything, nearly everything, whether the categories be biological or psychological or chemical or even theological. But we still don't quite know how to name God or ourselves in our relationship with God, not to mention Jesus. Some of the old ways seem to have been hijacked. Say Christian in our marketplace today and feel the cringe. Many of us feel the need to add a qualifier to our Christian name. We are a progressive Christian or a conservative Christian. We are Canberra Anglicans or we are Sydney Anglicans or just Anglicans because we don't want to say Christian. So sometimes we settle for something a little vague and we settle for less. In our culture, that is all about acquiring more. We have many ways of settling for less. We might leave unanswered the almost forgotten longings of our youth or the nagging questions of the moment. We might stop wrestling with hard ethical choices about how to be followers of Jesus in our day. It's just so demanding. So we slide into personal devotion for the God that is just for us. Or we fear getting too political with complicated justice matters like our voice to Parliament, so we settle for charity. We exercise religious rigour over our food choices, a decaf almond latte, if you please, rather than any spiritual practice. And we erect our altar to that unknown God, a polite little God that asks little of us. Paul is enraged by what he sees. He moves from the marketplace to the Areopagus, which was a gathering place and the name for the select group of city leaders who met there to debate and decide matters of civic interest and concern. Anything from legal and political matters to religious and philosophical positions as well. They were brilliant men, the most outstanding thinkers and scholars. This city took pride in its intellectual prowess, a bit like Canberra. This was the Harvard, the Oxford, the Cambridge. This city could boast such thinkers as Plato and Socrates and Aristotle amongst its old boys. Yet despite these distinguished graduates, their ignorance of God supported Paul's great statement that the world through wisdom did not know God. Paul then respectfully gives his speech. He stands and offers initial remarks to the city leaders, which reflect on what he's seen in Athens since his recent arrival. Objects of worship everywhere. As I indicated previously, the Athenians had gods for practically every natural occurrence or life event. Birth, death, love, wisdom, warfare, travel, language, music, arts, family life, childbirth, parties, festivals, agriculture, drought, flood, just to name a few. These gods tended to be a capricious lot and had to be bribed or sacrificed to in order to assure their positive attention. And then there was the matter of an altar to an unknown god. Paul praises the religious impulse that has them trying to cover every possible base or every possible god, even the ones they may not know about. And we had just heard a few verses earlier in verse 16 that Paul is greatly distressed by the idolatry of the city. But now that he's doing his speech, he is capturing the benevolence of his audience. A clever move. Find the seeds of the word, the logos, in whatever culture you're in. I've heard it said that you can't evangelize a culture you don't love. A little bit like us and my children. If we listen to words that condemn coming from someone that we suspect doesn't love or care enough to get to know us, we are much less likely to take heed. I think Paul's demonstration is so relevant for us in a world of polarization and cancel culture, where people refuse to engage with others that think differently and remain in their bubbles. Paul teaches us to look for the good as a point of engagement. Now, some critics think that Paul is being sarcastic here, making fun of idol worship, getting ready for the big takedown. But I see it more as an example of the advice given in our First Peter reading today. Always be ready to make your defense to anyone who demands from you an accounting for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and reverence. Perhaps Paul has learnt from his previous times in Thessalonica and Berea. He points out that God is deeply ingrained in the hearts and consciousness of us all. These philosophers show that they were aware that there are powers above us, around us, and inside of us. Of course, today we label their altars primitive superstition. But we have our own gods just as controlling of our daily lives. We think we've got all those natural occurrences figured out, so we worship the gods of technology. These gods dominate our time and imagination. They offer promises of control and knowledge and pretty much take all the mystery and wonder and true reverence out of our lives. In his book, Counterfeit Gods, the pastor Timothy Keller identifies the altars we make to power, success, romance, money, busyness, and even family. Keller argues that when we place too much importance on these things, they can become idols that dominate our lives and ultimately leave us feeling unfulfilled. He also suggests that even good things like family or career success can become idols if we begin to value them more than our relationship with God. Presbyterian pastor Eugene Peterson, author of The Message, says that even the religious marketplace can be idolatrous. God can be packaged as a product, God depersonalized and made available as a technique or a program. One of the reasons I loved oncology nursing was because when facing a life-threatening illness, it forces us to think and evaluate what matters most for the remaining times left. Being with people when they realise that the promotion they were chasing, the waterfront they wanted, wasn't actually as important as relationships was amazing. And they were reborn or reset for the time they had left. Wherever I nursed, I could see the idols of the place I lived in. In Sydney, the fancy house by the water, the posh schools, the black Range Rovers. In Darwin, the impressive boat or the cool gear. And in Canberra, the public service level or your postdoctoral work or how many publications has your writing been featured in. So, what does your favourite altar say about you and the God that you serve? What consumes you? What controls you? Paul, having complimented, he now critiques. He says that God doesn't live in temples of human hands. I can just imagine Paul saying this because where he was standing when he gave this speech in the Areopagus was right below the Parthenon, which was the greatest pagan religious temple in the world, and at the heart of it was a giant statue of the goddess Athena. So you can imagine him standing there saying, God doesn't live in temples of human hands, pointing up. In her book, An Altar in the World, Anglican priest Barbara Brown Taylor writes, as important as it is to mark the places where we meet God, I worry about what happens when we build a house for God. Do we build God a house so that we can choose when to go see God? Do we build God a house instead of having God stay at ours? Plus, what happens to the rest of the world when we build four walls, even four gorgeous walls, cap them with a steepled roof and designate it the house of God? What happens to the riverbanks, the mountaintops, the desert and the trees? What happens to the people who never show up in our houses of God? God is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples made by human hands. Paul then makes the great Christian claim, the claim that is not intellectual, not even rational. We can know God. We have seen God, he says. He tells them about the Creator God, the one who made the world and all the world, the Jews, the Greeks, the Romans, the slaves, the soldiers, and even the women. He says that the way of this God stands in contrast to the way of empire. He does this, it's very clever, with a play on the word for world. There are two different ways to say world in Greek, kosmos and oikoumene. The first word, kosmos, mentioned in verse 24, refers to the created order, that which was called good in the Genesis account of creation. But the second, oikoumene, mentioned in verse 31, is the world that God will cast judgment on. It is a far cry from the goodness of creation. The second is a creation of humans, empire. The way of this God stands in contrast to the way of empire. Paul then quotes Epimenides and Aratus, their own philosophers. This is a great lesson in interfaith dialogue. Paul makes his case for the gospel not by trashing their beliefs and philosophers, but by quoting them. He immerses himself in their thinking and uses their symbols and ideas. We live in a world where religious diversity is the norm, where people of many faiths and beliefs coexist side by side. And yet too often we see these differences as something to be feared or avoided rather than opportunities for connection and growth. By immersing himself in the other's worldview, Paul is building bridges. Paul says God's not restricted to a ritual or caged in a creed or limited to an institution, but can be seen alive in all of creation. This is the God, Paul preaches, in whom we live and move and have our being. In whom we live and move and have our being. So just as fish swims in water and that water keeps the fish alive, so God is the ocean in which we swim and thereby live. God isn't remote, but instead is actually intimately present everywhere, such as we who are inside God, saturated with God through and through, and at the same time utterly dependent on God, not just for daily bread, but also for our ongoing life and movement and being itself. In short, for Paul, we are creatures in symbiotic communion with God. As Jesus puts it in our John reading, because I live, you will also live. As we reflected on clergy conference this week, I am the vine, you are the branches. Abide in me as I abide in you. A human relationship with God then isn't about relating to a far off presence, nor is it about relating to a merely interior one, nor is it a matter of luring God to come closer. if we take Paul's speech at the Areopagus seriously, God is already there. God is already here. It's we who need to become more present and attentive. The divine life is swirling in and through and around all things all the time, all the way out to the edges of creation and beyond. We can't enhance the degree to which we have our being in God. The very fact that we are in any given moment, we owe to God's ongoing generosity. The great rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel once said, "Faith is not the clinging to an altar, but an endless pilgrimage of the heart." While we can't increase the amount we are in God, we can become pilgrims and enhance the degree to which our hearts are aware of this symbiosis, the degree to which we're thankful for it, and the degree to which we live and act accordingly. The Franciscan author Father Richard Rohr says that all spiritual teaching and all spiritual traditions, including Christianity, are trying to teach us to be present to the presence of God. But the problem is, he says, we are almost always somewhere else. We are either reprocessing the past or we are worrying about the future. Richard Rohr says it this way: the presence of God is infinite, everywhere, always, and forever. You cannot not be in the presence of God. There is no other place to be. The only change is always on our side. God is present, but we are not present to the presence. What would it mean for you and whatever fear you are facing right now to practice being present to the presence? Coming back to Paul, he reaches his final point, which each step of Paul's argument has led to. He has acknowledged the universal human spiritual yearning and the desire to live our lives according to some ultimate loyalty or object of belief. He then argued that the Athenian unknown God is the universal God who transcends the provincial and is the God of the many, not the few, who is close to us and can be found. And then he offers them his proof. God says that the God of all is not unknown, but is present here and now. He says we've seen this in a human person, in the living and dying and the living again of a man, Jesus Christ. Paul's claim is outrageous. It is the claim of Easter. God replaces despair with hope. God replaces life beyond death. This is not one more philosophy to debate. This is about a God we can name. Notice that the climax is not Jesus' death, but rather his resurrection. Indeed, Jesus' death features in Paul's proclamation here only insofar as death makes resurrection possible. For in raising him from the dead, Paul declares, God has given assurance to all that in the end, Jesus, the strong and tender shepherd, the challenging and merciful teacher, the one who said, "If you love me, keep my commands," and whose new commandment is to love one another as I have loved you. In short, resurrection is a reassuring signal that love will have the final word. So, can I encourage you as you leave today to ponder these wonderful words of Paul's, that the Creator God, whose ways are different to the ways of this world, who wants to be in relationship with us and is calling us to put down our phone, put down our devotion to busyness, put down our addictions to work, and see that God is all around us and within us, giving us life and breath and our very being, calling us to be present to God's presence, present to the power of love, and present to the ways of the one who lived and died and lived again. Amen.